This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty. Welcome to episode 12 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have longtime Washington, D.C. sports media personality Bram Weinstein joining us. Bram, who hosts the afternoon show on ESPN 630, the sports capital, and is also the play-by-play voice of the Washington Commanders. Bram, thanks so much for joining us today. Obviously, D.C.'s NFL team has made a lot of headlines in recent years, usually negative headlines, but with Daniel Snyder out, Josh Harris in, it's a new era, maybe a breath of fresh air. What was Thursday and Friday of last week like?
It was an enormous deal, and it can't be understated. You know, I grew up here, so I'm kind of living a dream job. I get to call the games of the team that I love the most. I grew up in the Washington area and went to RFK Stadium as a kid. And if you listen to the press conference of, you know, the what they're calling the managing director and many of the members of the new ownership group, it's a very large group. They went through the same thing. They went through a glory day era. They understand that this organization was in a very different place. And it's been a long time. And there's been some erosion here of the fan base. And this is one of the most loyal, passionate fan bases that you will find. When I was a kid, when the Redskins won the Super Bowl, they shut down the entire school system in the entire region. And I'm the entire school system. Like, that's how this team affects this area. It used to change the mood of the city by wins and losses. And this was a necessary move. I'm going to be the one in the million that doesn't have a lot of bad things to really say about Daniel Snyder, because he employed me and he gave me these jobs. And I've been around the team for a number of years. But I will say that, you know, it is clear that there was a change that was necessary. And I don't know what the future holds for them, but I do think the team is in better hands.
Yeah, you mentioned how the franchise does have such a loyal fan base. How frustrating was it for the fans that they were trying to root for a team, but also didn't want to support the owner? Like, they were rooting for a team that they couldn't really be proud of in recent years.
You know, we spent a lot of time on the air the last couple of years talking about this, that if you really kind of just, if you can separate the two sides, that's extremely hard to do. But if you can do that, like, what is not to like about Terry McLaurin, John Allen, Chase Young, Montez Sweat, Logan Thomas, you know, any number of players, what Ron Rivera is building on the field. And at the same time, everything that's happening off the field, all of these headlines, all these investigations, all these things that are happening, you know, I think it's very difficult for a lot of people to separate. And you saw that in ticket sales. You saw that in attendance. You saw the stadium get overrun with visiting fans when a premier team would come in. And that was really counter to everything that I was accustomed to growing up, being around the franchise. So there was an erosion. And, you know, we talked about this a ton. It was really hard to get people to separate that there is a good thing happening on one side, even if you have to kind of hold your nose on the other. And now that that's not there and not present any longer, the hope is that, like, the tent's big again, that that it's going to be open. You'll feel differently about supporting the franchise than maybe you have in recent years. And if you do look closely at what's on the field, you'll see 4 to 6 Pro Bowlers, a team with a top 5 defense, a team that, you know, that clearly this area still cares about. Like, it was never a case of ambivalence. That's where I would have gotten worried. It's never been ambivalent here about it. There was just a lot of anger. And hopefully this change, you know, changes a lot of that anger issue that people have had with trying to support the team.
You mentioned like not having a lot of bad things to say about Daniel Snyder. Obviously, he employed you. Did you have interactions and conversations with him in the last few years?
No, not really. He really wasn't around the team all that much, so yes, we didn't really see him very much. And in the last couple of years, you know, the league had imposed they didn't call it a suspension, but it kind of was a suspension, so he really wasn't around very much. So no. To short answer your question is, I haven't really had a lot of personal interactions with him in recent years.
Do you think that he grasped how much he was disliked by the fan base even before the toxic workplace allegations came out a few years ago? Because, like, a lot of sports owners are criticized by their fans because most of them don't win. Most of them make mistakes. Most of them can't really relate to the blue collar fan, but the vitriol towards Snyder was really on another level.
Yeah, I think you have to take that in like phases. Like early in his tenure, when he had 5 coaches in 6 years, you know, and was, you know, spending a lot of money on older players and trying to build a roster, it was all in the name of winning. So when he was criticized for hiring and then firing Steve Spurrier, hiring and firing Marty Schottenheimer, spending money on, you know, Bruce Smith and Deion Sanders that was misguided towards their salary cap, spending their draft picks to get older players, and it failing, the way he kind of looked at it was, I may be making mistakes, but it's not in the name of not winning. Like, isn't this what the fans want? Right. As things kind of progressed and things changed over really the last 5 to 10 years, the stories became very different. And I think last year, the epitome of it was, and, you know, again, like I can't speak for him or what bubble he was in or what, you know, what he's paying attention to or not paying attention to. The idea that he would have thought that he was beloved, I think, would be preposterous. But like, but to sit there and go like he's day to day thinking, you know, like that everybody hates me. I can't speak for him or think that way. But last year in the stadium, Tonya Snyder had become the, you know, the forward face of the franchise, you know, by virtue of what the league had kind of put down on sanctions on the team off of the workplace environment stuff. She was spearheaded the NFL's breast cancer awareness campaign years ago because she's a survivor. And every year, obviously, everybody wears pink in the NFL. There's a week where, you know, it's a raise, you know, awareness for breast cancer week, and everybody wears something that's pink. And she did something on the Jumbotron at FedEx Field, just talking about, you know, what they're doing this year, whatever the initiative was this year. And the fans booed her. And, you know, that was, even for me, it was like, all right, you know, like, slow down a second here. Like, do you realize what she's trying to promote here? Yeah. Like, what this initiative is? And if there ever was a wake-up call, I think for the family, it probably was that moment where she's being booed for doing something really wonderful for the community, and it almost kind of gave you the sense that there really isn't much that they could do right.
Yeah. Do you think there were times over the years that he was unfairly blamed for some things? Like, I'm a Mets fan. I'm a Knicks fan. So the Knicks fan base really hates Dolan. The Mets fan base used to hate the Wilpons before Steve Cohen came in. But like, if you were leaving the parking lot and there was an abnormal amount of traffic, like you could probably find fans blaming that traffic on the Wilpons a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Do you think that Snyder was also unfairly blamed for some things at times?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Like I said, early in his tenure, I would say yes. Like you had to understand why he was doing what he was doing. He was trying to win. It was misguided in the way he went about winning. But like, since you're a Mets fan, I would say this, you know, even about the current ownership, because you didn't mention them by name, but like, do you think what they're doing to build their roster is a good thing? You know that he's doing it all in the name of winning. He just might not be getting those decisions right. So he's willing to put his money up to try to build the best roster possible. So can you really blame him for that? You know, so I think that there's some similarities there with something like that. Dan Snyder was doing kind of F them picks early in his tenure before it was vogue to do it. He was hiring big name Hall of Fame level coaches at the time. He wasn't giving them time to grow a roster. He wasn't giving them time to build a culture. He was very impatient, but it came from a place of trying to win as a fan. And because there was so much change, turmoil, overhaul, all these decisions never worked out, people then started to blame him, which I think probably happened, you know, to some of the teams that you've talked to. That point, but what it got to the last 5 to 10 years was something. I tweeted out something last week, like, how's everybody feeling today after the sale went through? And somebody replied, and I thought it really kind of hit the nail on the head. He said, you know what, I just don't feel like any longer it's immoral to root for them. And that's the level it got to. I think, you know, we as sports fans and people who care about these teams, if the ownership is putting their best foot forward and trying to win, then the chips will fall where they may, and you can criticize what they do, but at least you know what their goals are. You know, the last 5 to 10 years, with all the things that were happening in the building, it just became very difficult to separate what was happening on the field from what was happening on the other side of the building.
I would imagine you've hosted a variety of fan events. Certainly you talk to fans on your radio show, things like that. Host probably some Q&As even. How often is the topic quickly changed, even if it's not meant to be about Snyder? How often was the topic usually shifted to the owner?
Constantly. Yeah. And I talked about this a lot. Like, I would do a million fan events, right? Especially starting now. Training camp opens for our team today. And so starting now, there will be events that I'll do with fans. I love doing them. And almost invariably with every panel, you know, there would be questions about the team and questions about, you know, how do we feel about this? Or, you know, do you think Sam Howell's going to be good? You know, the typical usual questions that come along with covering a football team. And then invariably, you know, somebody would ask a question about ownership and the air would just get sucked out of the room. And you could feel like, I'll go back to what I said earlier, there's no ambivalence, like, which is the good news. You know, like, nobody's ambivalent about it. They're still the most important sports property here. There was almost just this sense of anger that people were kind of putting up with it, as opposed to, you know, just kind of unequivocally rooting for it. And that, you know, that's difficult. You know, it's just difficult. But I understood where everybody was coming from. You know, it wasn't like a, what are you talking about? Or you're trying to sugarcoat something. Like, I'm living through this too, and I want what's best for the team because I know what's best for the team is best for our community. Like, this team galvanizes our community. Like, very few teams can galvanize a community. And that's why people were so angry about what was going on. This is the lifeblood of our sporting universe here. No offense to the other teams. And we have an all-time great player in Alex Ovechkin. And people still love the Wizards, even though they can't get out of their own way. And the Nationals just won a World Series not that long ago. Like, we love our sports teams around here, but nothing is the Redskins / Commanders. Nothing is them. They are the number one team in the city. And people were just angry that it was hard to wrap your arms around them and give them a hug.
Yes. Snyder, he made defiant statements that he would not sell the team. He made defiant statements that he would not change the name. Both of those ended up happening. Yeah. Which one was more surprising to you?
Selling the team. But yeah, I mean, in the end, like, the changing the name part was really out of his control. He didn't want to do that, you know. And I think if you asked a lot of people around here, they would wish that there's a mixed review about whether he should have or shouldn't have, because we here locally know what the intentions of the name were. Not that I'm trying to lay groundwork for them going back to it. That's not happening. But the point is, like, he never wanted to do that. And there's a lot of, and we could spend a long time talking about what happened as to why that ended up happening. But his former minority owners kind of forced the issue. We were at a time culturally where these things became very unacceptable in the moment, and some corporate money got behind, you know, a campaign to get it changed, and the NFL stood behind that campaign, and so they changed it. And what's done is done, right? You know, like, it was time for it to change. It's changed. It's over with. And Dan Snyder really, you know, he didn't want to do it. So, you know, for the record, he didn't want to do that. As for selling the team, I never thought he would. But, you know, that's another complicated story that starts and ends with, you know, what happened in the workplace environment, Congress getting involved, and then ultimately, you know, the inability to land a new stadium deal here and the bottom line of what, you know, the future was for the team in terms of having a modern stadium. That to me was like one of the underrated but biggest parts of all of this, that this team, it felt, needed new ownership to reengage with the local jurisdictions to get the stadium that they eventually need to get into.
Did you think that the rebrand was going to buy him more time than it did?
I wasn't sure.
Are you surprised? You know, like, are you surprised how closely the rebrand happened, and then he essentially sells the team right after that?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that they're totally connect. I mean, they are in a timeline connected. I don't think he did it to buy time. I think when Congress reopened their investigation into the team after we thought that that investigation was over, after then local jurisdictions opening up investigations into financial improprieties. And then lastly, and most importantly, in terms of the financial situation with the team, the inability to get a stadium site, which they've sought after for a long period of time in any of the three jurisdictions here, Maryland, Virginia, or the District of Columbia, I think was ultimately the things that did this. So they're connected and not. Like, he didn't do it as a cover, if that's, you know, what anyone's trying to insinuate. And because that happened when it did not feel as, like, they started that process way before they thought about selling the team or really considering selling the team.
Yeah. Yesterday morning, I saw on WFAN Boomer Esiason and Greg Giannotti, they helped the Jets unveil the fact that they were going to be wearing retro jerseys from the sack exchange this year. And I saw a couple other franchises did something similar this week. And obviously we understand why the team moved on from the Redskins name, but the franchise does have a rich history. Do you think they'll ever wear throwback uniforms?
I hope so. I do. I hope so. You know, honestly, when they were the Washington football team a couple of years ago and they wore basically the same color scheme and the only thing that was really different was the helmet and they put numbers on their helmet, I thought it was a very good look for them. We liked the classic look. The colors carried over with the transition. I think if you did a straw poll here and asked them, you know, what do you want them to do? I think largely at least the loudest segments of the fan base will tell you they want to change the name again. To what? I don't really know. And the ownership was asked about this, and the ownership did not shut the door on it. So I don't know if it's going to happen fast or if it's going to happen over the course of time, but I'm pretty convinced that this is not the team name in the long term. What they'll go to, I don't know. And one of the easiest things for them to do, and because I do, you know, not unlike since you're up in New York, like, I love the Giants classic look. I think it's their best look, that 1980s look with the script Giants across their helmet. Like, you know, that old Redskins look is classic. Now, can they actually put that helmet back on and not get a lot of pushback and brushback culturally? I don't know. Could they put on those uniforms, though, with that color scheme? Definitely. I don't know when they could do it by rule that you have to wait a certain amount of time when you have a rebrand to wear things like that. But I would think the sooner the better. And I think the fan base would agree with me that, like, it's their best look. That's our team. And I would expect that at some point you'll see it again.
Do you know... I would imagine that they could probably wear at least the throwback uniforms. They don't have to wait for a certain amount of time after the rebrand for that. Do you know that? Like, is that something that they would, the league would legally allow them to just wear them?
I'm not the right person to ask about this because I don't know what the rules are, but I believe you have to wait a couple of years after a uniform change to wear a throwback, but I could be wrong about that. What I think, but I could be wrong about that. You might want to check that, so I'm not sure. But that's I have my producer's very into merch and gear, and he has said things to me like that before, like, you know, they can't do this for a year or two, or they can't do that for a year or two because of these changes, because he seems to know what the NFL rules are with stuff like that.
Was there a name that you thought, like, did you think the Commanders was the right pick out of the options? Was there a better option in your mind? Was there an option that wasn't mentioned that you thought would have been the right fit?
I didn't, you know, when we went through the process, because it was like 2 years, I never, and I think a lot of people would agree with me that are fans of the team, I never heard one that was obvious. Like, there was never a, oh man, that's it. Like, no, I never heard that. And, you know, them landing on an agnostic military term always felt very logical to me. Like, not branch specific military term, because it symbolizes Washington, D.C. power, the military. That always made sense to me. You know, I'm not stepping out by saying that, like, this has not landed as the perfect name for the team, which is why I think they're talking about potentially, you know, doing something about it and potentially changing it. And I would expect that in the not too distant future after this season, it will be a topic that comes up again, and we'll see how the ownership answers that question about it. But there wasn't one. There was the name that, like, the really, really rabid fans that are, like, perpetually online and P1 into the team, they wanted the name Red Wolves for, I don't know what particular reason, because it's not like there's anything regional about that animal here. I think they liked having the name Red, you know, still in the name, and they kind of stuck to this. And the team looked into it, but there was a copyright issue. I believe it's Arkansas State was this team, and they found that if they picked this name, it would have either ended up in a, you know, in litigation for a long time, or it would have been exorbitant to pay for the rights. And so the team decided not to go in that direction. But that's like the loudest faction of the really engaged fans were openly saying they wanted that. And the team did look into it. And outside of that, there was no front runner. There was nothing that anybody was like, oh man, that's got to be it. And so when they landed on Commanders, I think the issue all along was, there was nothing that had formed a consensus before they chose it.
Yeah. The fan base is relaxed. Maybe they have a sense of excitement. They have a bit of a sigh of relief, the fact that there's a new owner. What about the players, the coaches, the staff, maybe even yourself? Obviously, everybody's kind of protected by contracts, but is there a different feeling, the fact that there is a new owner who probably wants to bring in their own employees and their own staff in the coming years?
Well, I mean, sure, from that perspective, you know, everybody's got to be realistic and know that they are going to make changes, like in whatever those changes may be. And, you know, so like we're all aware of that. And the way I look at it is all I can do is just the best job I can do and be a good representative of the team, like I was under Daniel Snyder and will be under this ownership group, and hope that that's enough to like maintain my position for the bigger decisions that they need to make, like head coach and team president and all of that type of stuff. Listen, we're in a year transition. Nobody's oblivious to it. This is a big year for everybody. But I will say that, like, overall, while job security makes life difficult for sure, overall, there's just a different vibe. I think you said it in the beginning, like, there's just kind of a breath of fresh air. The clouds have lifted a little bit. Immediately after the sale was announced that it was going to go through a couple months ago, there were a number of players that went on Instagram and Twitter and places like that and basically asked the fan base, put aside your grievances, get behind us. And I think they had every right to do that. Like, as we talked about earlier, this is actually a pretty good roster and a pretty good team with a lot of really good high-character players on it. Like, what's not to like about Terry McLaurin? If you get to know who this person is, what's not to like about him? And yet people were having a hard time rooting for the jersey and rooting for the team. And it's people like that and the team that go, okay, you know, your grievances are over, right? Get back on board with us. And this first game against Arizona at home, the opener, is here. And, you know, in previous years, the attendance has been wonky at best. And at times, with premier franchises showing up, it can be overrun with visiting fans. You know, that shouldn't be the case. With the Arizona Cardinals on a 1 p.m. kickoff at FedEx Field, the stadium should be ripe for Burgundy and Gold to overtake it again. And I hope we see that. You know, and I think the players want to see that. And I think it would be a very good sign of things have changed.
What is it like being the play-by-play voice of the franchise you grew up rooting for? I know you mentioned that it was a dream growing up, but it happened later in your career. So even as you were doing other things in your career, did you maintain this as a goal the whole time?
Yes. It was the job that I dreamed of doing as a child. I'm only the third person to do it since 1979, so you better be patient about it, because this job doesn't open up very often. And when it does, it not only do you have to be ready for it, but you have to be right place, right time, available. They have to then want you. And so there's a lot of, you know, a lot that went into it that allowed me the opportunity to do it. Being the play-by-play voice of the team is by far, bar none and not close, the best job I've ever had in this industry. It's everything I had hoped it would be. And I do hope now that I think that, you know, like, and that's saying what it was, you know, like, now we have a situation where I think a lot of this anger towards the franchise should be alleviated, or hopefully we'll start the healing process of alleviating that for a lot of people that might want to get back into the Washington football team. And I'm hoping that that carries over so that we start having the community feel of the team that I had growing up that made me want to do this job in the first place. Like, the galvanization of our community is the reason why I fell in love with this team and fell in love with the sport and fell in love with what they meant to us. And I'm hoping that they can bridge that meaning again. And being any part of it, especially this part of it, is a privilege and an honor to do. And I'll do it for, I told them this when they hired me, I'm never quitting. You're going to have to fire me. So, you know, hopefully I can maintain this position for as long as possible, because I dearly love it. And I love being, you know, a passionate, loyal representative of what I believe is the most important sports franchise in our nation's capital.
What was your play-by-play background before getting the job?
Not a ton. I had called games for my alma mater, American University Basketball, for a couple of seasons before I went to ESPN. And then while I was at ESPN, I did have a desire to do play-by-play, and I vocalized that to the people there. I was mainly on SportsCenter and other studio shows, but they did let me do, I'd say, a dozen, maybe 15 college basketball games through my career. So it was not extensive at all, but I did have some experience.
So were you surprised that you were able to land the job without having to do like years of college or high school play-by-play first?
Not in my case, just because I had worked with the organization, you know, in various roles. So the relationship was there. They trusted me. I had done studio shows for them. I had been a guest for them. I'd done reports for them. I had been on the broadcast team previous to going to ESPN as the sideline reporters. I'd already been on the broadcast team before. Yeah. So I think, like, I don't know if an exception was made. They did make me audition for it, and they did make me do a couple of mock games, because then I wanted to do that too, but I wasn't worried. I wasn't worried. It's a different skill set, and I acknowledge that. I think it's very different than anything else you do. But, you know, I kind of liken it to this. When I went to ESPN to become a television anchor, I had never been a television anchor before. So, you know, I think there are different skill sets and there's different parts of the craft. But I think, like, I know how I prepare. I know this team. You know, I know I've watched every play and been around and read everything about them and been around them for as much as possible since I was six. So knowing about them, having the institutional background, having the loyalty and the passion, that was there. It was just going to learn a craft, and it took a little time, but it became relatively seamless, I think, you know, for me.
Was it difficult that the first year you were doing it was in a pandemic year? Like, were you traveling with the team? Were you in the same room as your broadcast partners?
Yes, we were. We did it from the stadium. We did not travel to away games. We had, you know, because the stadium is hooked up with all the TV trucks, we could get all the various replays. But my first season as a play-by-play voice, we were calling a lot of games off television, which was not, you know, ideal for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, our broadcast team kind of looks at it as it's never going to be harder than it was the first season. And I even think the harder part was, and you underestimate this until you're there doing it, the no crowds. The no crowds was really odd and strange. Like, we had a home playoff game, Taylor Heinicke versus Tom Brady. It's the third quarter. Taylor Heinicke makes this crazy run, dives for the pylon, scores. It's at home. It's a home game. There's nobody there but us. Nobody. You know, there's like 100 people in the stadium but us. I know what the sound in the stadium would have been to make it a two-point game when he scored this touchdown late third quarter, but there is no sound in the stadium, and it's weird and dystopian, and it's hard to describe. Like, the energy of the crowd kind of feeds you when you do something like this, and when they're not there, it is so obvious. So that's why I say, like, it'll never, even if we have technical challenges, it'll never be harder than doing it that first year.
Yeah, for sure. So how was it the first time you were in FedEx Field to call a game in front of a full crowd? Were there added nerves? Was there an adrenaline rush?
There's definitely an adrenaline rush. You get into the crowd, for sure.
Yeah.
But it, like, I wouldn't say there was no additional nerves. It was, I'm just so happy everybody's back, because to me, the fans are the soundtrack of the whole thing. Like, they are the ones that kind of feed the energy back to you, and you know what to give back to them. Without them there, it's not that you're not guessing, but it just sounds off. The soundtrack is off. If I'm like hitting these high notes when these crazy things happen and there's literally no response behind you, it's dystopian. Yeah. So the crowd being there really, to me, is everything.
Is it difficult being the Commanders play-by-play voice and a local radio host in the city? Like, are you able to give the honest commentary and criticize the team enough when needed, or do you need to temper those emotions a bit?
Well, this is going to be aired, so how am I doing here? Am I being
I'm actually pretty impressed. Yeah, I think you've been honest and reasonable about all the stuff you've been saying.
No, I think I think, as you know, I've kind of always taken the position of, like, for me, this team, they are kind of like my family, and at times on Sundays, my religion. And, you know, with your family and your religion, not everything they do is great. And so you got to be open to having open conversations with them about how we function together. And I think that's healthy. You know, like, to sit there and pretend that everything is great all the time is just not reality about anything. And I don't think, you know, as a radio host or a host, I don't think my audience wants to hear me. We're not stupid. You know, like I've always said, like, this is a very educated fan base here. I'm not talking down to anybody. I'm talking with everybody. And if we're not having honest conversations, then I'm not doing my job. Now, on Sundays, when I call the games for the team, I kind of keep most of my opinion out of it because that's just not my job. Like,
yeah.
I'm there to set up my analysts, London Fletcher, Julie Donaldson, you know, anyone else we may have in the booth. I may frame a question a certain way to try to elicit answers, but I'm there to call a game. I'm a representative of the team. And from 1 to 4, frankly, like, to go back to, like, your previous, you know, thoughts about, like, everyone's blaming Dan Snyder for everything, when they fail to get a 3rd and 2, you know, and have to punt in a 1-score game in the 4th quarter, that's not Dan Snyder's fault. So I got to be, you know, I'm just telling the story of a game on that day.
Yeah. Have you ever been told that you said something on the radio that was too critical or anything like that?
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody goes through it, but nothing that really, I think most of the time, if those conversations happen, it's typically someone saying, I think you should know this for context. Okay. So that, you know, that's how it really goes. It's very rarely like, sure. Like, I think everybody who covers a team goes through that. And in my position, you know, yes, it's a little more tenuous and I'm aware of that, you know, like that. I don't want to make anybody angry, but, you know, at the same time, I've got an audience to cater to that wants to hear the unvarnished truth. And, you know, there are limits because, you know, the hardest part for me, honestly, is that I see more than most of the other media. Like, I'm allowed access to practices that they're not because of my job. And so I have to be very careful, and I would never, ever, ever want to put this team at a competitive disadvantage by saying something that I saw that was not to be revealed for public consumption.
Sure.
So on that side, if I ever do anything like that, I would expect to be fired. And so I'm very careful about that stuff. But telling the story of the team, even if it's controversial, every once in a while I'll say something and somebody will call me and go, I think if you knew this beforehand, you wouldn't have said that. And it's just for context.
Right. What are realistic expectations for the team this season?
So, you know, I know what the national pundits say about them, but I think they're underselling them a little bit, and I'll tell you why. One, they had a top 5 defense a year ago that did not cause a lot of turnovers. They addressed that in the draft, at the top of the draft, and so far so good what it looks like with their top 2 picks, and specifically their first-round pick corner, Emmanuel Forbes, who's got some Sauce Gardner vibes to him. So this is a team that basically didn't have their best playmaking defensive lineman, Chase Young, on a line of playmakers. They had the number 3 defense, and they were not getting a lot of turnovers. They've addressed this, and they get Young back, who should be motivated on a expiring contract. And I think it's not an exaggeration to say that they've got 4 to 6 Pro Bowlers on this team, because they already do, and Chase Young didn't play. So you tell me how a top 5 defense with 4 to 6 Pro Bowlers ends up with a terrible record. I don't see that at all. Now, the big question is, do they have a quarterback? And that's an open question, and it's been the open question for this franchise for years, and it has not been satisfied with Sam Howell yet. He's played 1 game. He's inexperienced. Their offensive line is a big question mark, whether they're going to be able to protect. And so let's see with him, because I think we all know that if the quarterback play is substandard, they won't go anywhere. If the quarterback play is average with the defense that they have, they might be pretty good with some breaks. And if he's better than people expect, and I'm hoping that's the case, I wouldn't be surprised that they have an over 500 record. And I know that would surprise some people this year.
I want to ask a couple of ESPN questions and SportsCenter questions. How did you enjoy working on SportsCenter for, what was it, 7 years that you did that?
I was at ESPN for 7 years. I was on a variety of studio shows, you know, ESPN News, college basketball studio shows, then SportsCenter, and then I was mainly on SportsCenter the last 4 to 5 years. I was mainly a SportsCenter anchor, and I loved it. Specifically, my last few years where I was on a stable show, many of us, you probably know this because you talk to everybody, many of us who get there, your schedule flips around, you work with a lot of different people, you know, and that's all well and good. There's nothing wrong with it. And then when you finally land with a partner and a show group where it becomes consistent, I think that's where things grow and get better. And when I finally landed with Sarah Walsh as my co-anchor doing the weekend sports centers, that's where things really clicked for me there. And that's when I loved really being there. And it was a great experience. I learned television there. I'm indebted to them. You know, I think without that experience, I don't know that I couldn't come back here and do the jobs that I'm doing now. And so I really had a wonderful experience working there.
Every anchor kind of has their own flair and style. When anchoring a sports center, how much of it did you write, or how much input did you have into some of the commentary?
So I took pride in writing everything I was going to say.
Oh, really?
I believe, you know, with exceptions, you know, if something breaks, a producer has to write it for you. You know, obviously late shot sheets coming in to do a late breaking highlight. Like, you don't write any of that. They don't write what you're going to say. You have to color in, you know, they give you who, what, when, where, and you have to be able to color it in. That's one of the skill sets you need to have, especially on like a night sports center, because you just, you know, the rundowns don't matter anymore because something's going to happen. It's going to change the whole thing. And someone's going to walk up to you and hand you something and say, read this in 30 seconds. So you have to get accustomed to doing something like that. But all the leads, everything else, I wrote it. And I don't know. I work with a lot of young broadcasters. I tell them, if you don't know how to write, you're never going to be good at this industry. Like, it's the basis of literally everything we do. So I took a lot of pride in writing it. Sarah did too. A lot of the anchors I did. I'm not suggesting most of them don't. Like, I used to be in awe of working with John Anderson because he walked into the studio with, you know, dictionaries and like he was a wordsmith. And so you knew, like, you better bring it with him because the way he's going to write something is going to be different than everybody else. And it became kind of almost competitive among the anchors, at least to me, to try to outdo their work. So I took that part very, very, and still do, very, very, very seriously. Like, I do my own boards when I get ready for the games. I put my own stats. I put my own notes. I write my own leads. I feel like if it's not in your voice, it'll never be authentic to you.
Was it cool getting to do This Is SportsCenter commercials? Like, was that almost like an honor when you were asked to do that?
Yes, that was a huge honor. That was really cool to do. I have up, you know, in my house, the things that I have from ESPN that are hanging up are autographed scripts and pictures from those tapings, like one with Rafael Nadal, two specifically because they're players that played here, Steven Strasburg and Bryce Harper. Those were just, like, that was a real honor. I mean, because they really entrust you as someone that represents the brand when they put you in something like that. And, you know, I think we all have egos. And to be told, like, hey, here's something you could do, and we think you could be funny at it, you know, I think it's a real kick. It was a hoot. I love doing it.
The SportsCenter brand, it doesn't quite mean what it once did in the 90s, even the early 2000s, even the early 2010s. Like, it has changed. Is that ESPN not developing personalities such as Dan Patrick, Stuart Scott, Rich Eisen, or is it more just the nature of highlight shows essentially are now sharing things that most fans already are seeing on social media?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is ESPN go back to a personality-driven format, and I don't blame them. I think it is. I personally think it's the way to go. I know there's been a lot of, you know, consternation about this thing going away and a lot of cuts, and then they hire like big name talent. Like, I don't blame them for a second for going out and acquiring Pat McAfee. I think it was a perfect hire in this day and age for a company like that to go back to that kind of personality-driven model. Because look what's happening. I think it's we're in a fractured environment. The audiences are everywhere. You know, people who want more of their own team or their own league can follow certain things. There's been disruptive shows throughout the marketplace that probably started with Barstool and have ended up in other places like The Ringer and all sorts of other and Meadowlark and all these different places that have like put together quality programming that is fractured and chipped away at ESPN's kind of stranglehold on sports media. ESPN, I mean, like, you got to remember, like, ESPN started the downfall of local news in sports departments. And now the internet, Twitter, YouTube, all these different podcasts, all these different spaces have chipped away at what ESPN was, which is appointment viewing for all these different things. That said, you know, is the SportsCenter brand hurt? I don't know. Scott Van Pelt does really well at night under the guise of a SportsCenter brand. So they're figuring it out. And, you know, I just think we're just in a different space. What we all know to be true is that sports content, it really matters. And it's just evolving like any other time, you know, like any other time in the history of media, it's just evolving. And I'm pretty convinced ESPN, with the resources they have, are going to figure it out. And they will maintain their foothold as the most important sports rights entity group and their most important sports content entity group. But clearly, they have a lot more challengers and a lot more things to think about as they try to rebuild for the future.
As somebody that works in the industry and also mentors younger broadcasters in the industry, and then you obviously see the attention that people like Skip Bayless and Stephen A. Smith command on social media with all of their quick clips. Do you have any thoughts on what they have done or what they mean to the sports entertainment industry?
You mean like the Levitard thing where he doesn't like I wouldn't go that far. I hear what Dan was saying. I do. I hear what he was saying because it's not, it was never my style, right? To try to figure out things to say that would be provocative. So that's just not, that's not my style, you know, but, you know, I think the audience tells you what you want. Like if there was a pushback to that style of, you know, content, then it would have happened. All that's happened is the audiences for that style of broadcasting have grown. So the audience validates the truth. You may not like that, but it does. Like, I look at this too and I go, okay, like, it's not just sports. Like, look at news programming now. Like,
yeah,
news programming is Stephen A. and Skip, right?
Right.
But with way more at stake than whether you think Kevin Durant, you know, jumps from team to team and what that means for his legacy or anything like that. So what I worried about was the proof of concept for many more dangerous styles of content that could affect our livelihoods, as opposed to, you know, whether they're being too harsh to this player or that player or this league or that league by coming up with hot takes. So I don't know. I think in the end, like, to me, the audience likes this. They won't like it forever because tastes change, but for now they do. And, you know, what Stephen A. Smith is doing is being validated every single day. And until it isn't, you know, like, I don't get what the criticism of it is. Like, the audience wants this. They're just giving it back to them.
Yeah. No, I think Stephen A. Smith and Skip Bayless are very good at it. I think part of the problem is, like you said, it's not everybody's style, but everybody sees that the audience kind of wants that and flocks to it. So then people that, if it's not their style, they just try to make it their style, even if it's not what they're necessarily comfortable with.
That's right.
And that's kind of where it hurts some of the others in the industry.
It's like music. It's like music. Like, I didn't know Taylor Swift would become the biggest artist in the world. You know, like, who knew that? But she is, you know, but she is. And maybe one day she won't be, you know, and like, and then maybe some other genre will become very, very, very popular for a period of time. Like, it's just, we're in a life cycle of media. It always comes and goes. And at some point, you know, what I do think Dan was right about was all the imitators and impersonators see this as their path into sports media. And typically the imitators and the impersonators are never the originators.
Yeah.
Therefore, the originators are going to be someone who comes up with something new. And that's why I look at someone like Pat McAfee and I go, I don't think he's doing that. You know, and that's why I think there's a popularity to him that should be able to be sustained.
Who did you aspire to be when you got in the sports media business, or who do you look up to? Who did you, or who do you look up to in sports media?
That list is long. Locally, and this is just for anyone local who watches this and will know this name, Glenn Brenner was a very famous sports anchor here locally who died at a young age, but he was kind of the first sports center-y styled local sports anchor, and he was just beloved in our area. And so I kind of, like, as a kid, because that's all you have are the three local stations and the radio, you know, they're kind of what, you know, I'm that age, you know, it's like those are the people you kind of watch. And, you know, I was very lucky growing up here. Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon were writing columns in my local newspaper, so I'm reading them every single day. Glenn Brenner, George Michael, you know, who I think maybe a national audience would know, kind of I wouldn't say originated SportsCenter, but was doing a national highlight show before anybody was doing a national highlight show, was here locally working in our market. So there was a lot of like local influence that happened for me by osmosis more than anything, and wanting to do this at a high level. It was incredible to see them work nationally. The list is really long. Like, yeah, I mean, like, I love calling play-by-play. I think I'm good at it, but Mike Tirico is unbelievable. And when I watch him, I'm jealous of it. Like, I watch this and I'm like, oh my God, he is absolutely amazing at that craft. And then I see him go host a studio show or do an interview show, and he's equally as good at all of those things. He, to me, is like the unicorn of the whole thing. Everything he does, he's amazing at. So I'm always kind of jealous of him. But I watch a lot of people. When I was at ESPN, I watched a lot of those anchors very, very, very closely. Just to see how do they do what they do? What do they do that I could incorporate that would be authentic to me? How do they work? How do they prepare? How do they project? How do they perform? And I was very lucky, like, to work at a place like ESPN and sit next to Scott Van Pelt or Stuart Scott, John Anderson, Steve Levy, Linda Cohn, Hannah Storm, Kevin Nagandi. Like, I'm going to forget names that I don't mean to. Just seeing how they all work really helped me get better at my own craft. And I would hope that on some level they looked at me and said, I like what he just did, and incorporated some of that.
Does hosting a radio show in Washington, D.C. lend itself to more political conversations at all? Are you cool with politics entering your show, or do you always try to stick to sports?
We do at times. I don't think it, like, again, like, our audience is like any other sports audience. Like, they're not tuning in for that. Like, they don't, yeah, they really don't care, you know, what my opinion is on Trump. You know, and I know that, like, it's impossible, I think, in this world not to incorporate it. And then when the politics seep into sports, it's really impossible not to, I think, acknowledge it and talk about it. But I don't, you know, we don't spend a lot of time, you know, and I, you know, like, our audience here, again, if you're tuning into my show, you're not tuning into, like, our sister station in our building under our media entity is WMAL. And they're a right-leaning media organization. So you want to hear it. It's right down the dial, or in my case, right down the hall when I get a coffee and a break.
Do you like political and news commentary? You had a little bit more of a political focus show in D.C. on the Fox affiliate with Britt McHenry, right?
Yes, I did. And yes, I do. I mean, like, I don't really aspire to do it.
Yeah.
But I'm interested in it, and I think, you know, in this day and age, not being in, I teach as well, I'm an adjunct professor, and we talk, I teach sports journalism, but we talk about this. If you're not engaged with what's going on right now, you may wake up one day and find out that this country is different. So I feel like it'd be impossible for me not to be a responsible adult and not be engaged with what's going on politically in our country right now. But I don't aspire to do that for a living. I like being in sports. I like sticking to sports. Sports are fun. I love calling football games, especially for a team that has this kind of long time, 90 plus year legacy in the nation's capital. I mean, there's no job I would want more than that.
And then last thing, you had started a podcast company. Is that's correct? Do you host a podcast as well? Or do you kind of just oversee other podcasts? What is that?
It's called Empire Media, AMPIRE, and I do host a sports tech show called Future Sport, which is really about the merge of technology into big-time sports. And then the other shows, I do not host any of them because I'm on the radio locally. I would be competing with myself, and I would be in breach of contract. So I don't do my own sports show on it. But, you know, who knows? Maybe one day. I like doing the radio, so I'm in no rush to leave. But it's there if I ever am to do that. And we have other shows that I oversee, and we're trying to build a, you know, a pretty good vertical and platform.
Good stuff. Bram, you were awesome. Thanks so much for the time today. I really appreciate it.
All right, my pleasure. Thanks.
That is Bram Weinstein. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at Awful Announcing.